à la première série de balado-diffusion organisée par le ministère de la Défense nationale et les Forces armées canadiennes sur la résolution 1325 du Conseil de sécurité des Nations unies ou la résolution 1325 du Conseil de sécurité. Le Conseil de sécurité a initialement adopté cette résolution sur les femmes, la paix et la sécurité le 31 octobre 2000. 20 ans plus tard, le ministère de la Défense nationale et des Forces armées canadiennes maintient toujours les valeurs que cette résolution avait initialement énoncées pour tous ses membres. La résolution réaffirme le rôle important des femmes dans la prévention et le règlement des conflits, les négociations de paix, la consolidation de la paix, le maintien de la paix, l'intervention humanitaire et la reconstruction après les conflits. Il souligne également l'importance de leur participation égale et de leur pleine implication dans tous les efforts de maintien et de promotion de la paix et de la sécurité. La résolution 1325 du Conseil de sécurité des Nations unies affirme que les efforts de paix et de sécurité sont plus durables lorsque les femmes sont des partenaires égaux dans la prévention des conflits violents et dans le processus de consolidation de la paix. De plus, l'égalité des sexes est essentielle pour relever les défis mondiaux les plus urgents, qu'il soit question de bâtir des économies qui profitent à tous ou de promouvoir la paix et la sécurité. Pour faire de notre monde un endroit plus juste, plus pacifique et plus sécuritaire, nous devons veiller à ce que les femmes et les filles puissent participer pleinement et librement à nos sociétés. En 2019, le premier ministre Justin Trudeau a annoncé la nomination de Jacqueline O'Neill à titre de première ambassadrice du Canada pour les femmes, la paix et la sécurité, et nous sommes très heureuses de l'accueillir dans cette conversation. C'est donc dans cet ordre d'idées que nous entamons la première discussion avec l'ambassadrice officielle du Canada, Madame Jacqueline O'Neill.
Hello and welcome to the third podcast hosted by the Department of National Defense on the anniversary of UNSCR 1325. And today we are lucky enough to have Ambassador Jacqueline O'Neill, who is the Ambassador for Women, Peace and Security here in Canada. And we are just thrilled to have a conversation digging more into those questions that we asked in previous podcasts, started off by my lovely colleague, Nadia.
Bonjour tout le monde. Je vais poursuivre la discussion en français avec la première question. Donc, que signifie la résolution 1325 du Conseil de sécurité des Nations unies pour vous en tant que dirigeante principale du lien entre les femmes, la paix et la sécurité et le gouvernement canadien? L'engagement personnel envers la résolution compte-t-il autant que l'engagement organisationnel?
Merci beaucoup, Nadia. Je vais répondre en français et en anglais, mais je vais commencer en anglais. I'll start with your first question about what it means to me, what women, peace, and security actually is. And to me, it means that everybody has an opportunity to influence the decisions that affect their lives, including on everything that relates to their own security and their loved ones' security. So that means having the chance to decide if they want to defend their country in uniform, if they want to influence what's in their constitution, or if they want to say in what issues are being negotiated in an attempt to end a war. So obviously, not everyone wants to exercise that opportunity, but the idea of women, peace, and security is about recognizing that there are often a lot of barriers in place specifically to women to doing so. And I'll add that to be clear, it does not mean that women are inherently more peaceful or somehow just better at men than doing any of that, or that any one woman should be in a job just because she wants it. It's just saying that women have important experiences and priorities, and we are all worse off when we prevent them from sharing those just because of their gender. Et puis, votre question sur l'engagement personnel envers la résolution, on ne m'a jamais demandé cette question de cette façon. Et ça me fait penser à un collègue, un Australien, qui est un grand champion des femmes, la paix et la sécurité dans les forces armées. Il m'a dit une fois, « Mon armée ne me consulte pas autour des modèles de chars d'assaut qu'il considère, par exemple. » Alors, quand chaque niveau de leadership dans votre organisation exprime que le respect et l'intégration des femmes est important, c'est important. Tu n'as pas le choix de simplement de opt-out ou de se désengager. Alors, je crois que c'est important d'avoir les politiques et les processus en place pour s'assurer que les gens comprennent ce qu'on attend de nous. Et heureusement, la grande majorité des personnes avec lesquelles nous travaillons veulent l'égalité des genres. Et ils savent que les femmes sont également capables. Ils veulent juste servir avec des gens qui font bien leur travail. Donc, ils ne voient pas de compromis. Ils n'ont pas un trade-off avec le talent.
Merci beaucoup, ambassadrice. Je suis totalement d'accord avec, avec ce que vous venez de dire. We're going to move on to question number two with Anna.
Great. Thank you so much, Ambassador O'Neill. So moving on to our second question, with the increase in conflict and humanitarian emergencies caused by climate change and a lack of natural resources, women and girls are disproportionately impacted. How should the Canadian government be preparing for the future within this context?
Thanks, Hannah. That's such a great question. And we're already seeing this play out in a lot of ways, really has been for decades already. So just to unpack the question, you know, what does it mean for women and girls to be disproportionately impacted? Because obviously violent conflict and humanitarian emergencies are generally terrible for everyone. So, you know, they generally tend to have the worst impact on people who are poorer. And women are a significant majority of the world's poor. So what does that mean in this context? They have less access to resources. So they're less likely to be able to flee, less likely to get access to a car or motorbike or any other form of transportation to evacuate from floods or forest fires. They have less resources to rebuild if their homes or businesses are destroyed, or even just to move if they can no longer farm their land, for example. So there's overall being poorer, and there are impacts that also relate to traditional gender roles. So for example, you know, in many parts of the world, women are responsible for collecting firewood or getting water. And as climate changes and we have droughts, for example, women need to walk further and further to get that water, get that firewood. And that means women spend less time in school. It also means that women and girls are at greater risk of being raped, especially when they're in the midst of conflict, and we hear about this a lot. Or that men have to go further to find space for cattle to graze. So the men are at greater risk. Women are left home alone, and they're often left behind with children for longer periods. So what can we do? You know, one thing is that we have to take seriously climate risk as an early warning indicator. And we have to make sure that we have systems in place to ask and then to listen to really diverse groups of women about what they're experiencing and how that's affecting their security. We have to really learn from diverse groups about what they're doing to mitigate risk. So what are they doing to manage food production, to manage runoff? What are they doing to manage their and use water resources responsibly? We have to listen to Indigenous people in particular about responsible management of natural resources. And I'm a huge believer in the importance of really fully incorporating GBA Plus into all of our monitoring and all of our response planning. So how do we get services to girls? How do we get them to women in rural areas? How do we support or protect or get services to older men and women who can't walk, to people with different disabilities? I think GBA Plus is just a great tool, and we have to integrate it fully into every aspect of planning, including as it relates to climate and to conflict.
I think that's such a great point, especially when we consider just the different intersectionalities that people may face when in conflict or when impacted by natural emergencies or disasters. And I think that often we're very privileged here in Canada that we don't think about the things that might impact certain groups more than others when natural disasters hit, because we have such robust systems in place to protect us when a natural emergency happens. But it's definitely not the case in many other countries, with even just the fact of being more coastal towns, or being that there's a better economy near coastal areas, and maybe that's also where possibly tsunamis happen, and so on and so forth. And I think it's so important to think about that kind of differential impact. And really extend our thoughts outside the norm of what we see as natural emergencies and how people are impacted here in Canada, how that differs.
Yeah, and you know, I'll add too that even in the flood, the military's support to flood victims in Gatineau a few years ago, and in other parts of Quebec, the military did GBA Plus, and they used that to figure out how to best distribute water to make sure that they weren't just dropping off water you know, at equidistant points, but figuring out which houses had pregnant women, elderly people, people who couldn't go to distribution points to get water. They were figuring out which groups of people were most likely to listen to their requests to evacuate. And one of the things they realized was that the group that was least likely to evacuate were men in their 30s and 40s. So one of the things they did was have other men in their 30s and 40s go to the front door and try to convince them. So I think GBA Plus is relevant everywhere all the time. And, you know, it's really about in service of achieving the goal of an operation. We have to figure out how different people are going to react to what we're trying to do and how to make sure that we're reaching people in the most effective way possible.
That's so great. Thank you so much. We're going to move on to question 3, hosted by Nadia.
Donc, voici la question numéro 3. Veuillez partager avec moi une expérience où vous avez vu de première main comment l'inclusion d'un plus grand nombre de femmes dans les processus de rétablissement de la paix ou de prise de décision a amélioré le fonctionnement, la politique ou le programme.
OK, so la première concerne en fait notre discussion sur le climat et les conflits. Il y a plusieurs années, des négociations de paix ont eu lieu de tenter de mettre fin à la guerre au Darfour. Et des personnes autour de la table de négociation étaient des médiateurs, le gouvernement de Soudan et de nombreux chefs rebelles. Et plusieurs de ces chefs rebelles vivaient en exil en Europe, mais sont venus à Abuja pour des entretiens. Et dans ce temps-là, notre envoyée canadienne, maintenant la sénatrice Mubina Jaffer, elle a dit, eh bien, nous pouvons amener aux négociations des seigneurs de guerre, nous pouvons amener des femmes. Alors, elle s'est donc arrangée pour qu'une dizaine de femmes viennent, incluant plusieurs qui venaient des camps de réfugiés au Darfour. Et elle n'était pas, bien sûr, officiellement invitée. Elle devait donc s'asseoir littéralement à l'extérieur. Et parfois, elles étaient consultées, mais souvent après que les problèmes avaient déjà été discutés. Et à un moment donné, les négociations se sont interrompues. Elles étaient coincées. Et il y avait une grande frustration de tous les côtés parce que les parties ne pouvaient pas s'entendre sur qui aurait le contrôle d'une rivière. Il y avait une impasse. Et les femmes ont venu dans la salle. Elles ont regardé la carte sur le mur et elles ont dit sept rivières ici. Oui, oui, nous ne pouvons pas être d'accord, etc. Et les femmes ont dit sept rivières a séché il y a 3 ans. Et j'aime bien cette histoire parce qu'elle démontre que ce n'est pas les femmes qui montrent plusieurs sujets, ce n'est pas seulement les femmes qui discutent plusieurs sujets, c'est plutôt que les gens ont des expériences vécues différentes et nous avons besoin de rendre notre travail pertinent pour tout le monde. So the second story I'll share really briefly. A couple of years ago, I was in Pakistan and I was working with a group of women from the police, from civil society and from parliament. And in Pakistan, fewer than 1% of the police and military are female. So less than 1%. And so we were working with several of them and we were doing a week-long workshop and we're in this hotel. Many people kind of had traveled from rural parts as well to come and stay in the hotel and we were doing this workshop. So on the first day of the workshop, there was headline news. It was on all the TVs around the lobby that the son of a Supreme Court judge in Pakistan had been kidnapped. And, you know, the country sees with this, the army's coming out saying, we're going to find him. We will bring the kidnappers to justice, et cetera. Big, big news story. And on about the, I don't know, maybe fourth day that we were there, we're all having breakfast. And again, the TV flashes up that the son had been found. And there was this big news conference by the head of the army. And then, you know, he's flanked by tons of uniformed men in the background. And they're saying, we caught these perpetrators, and what happened was it was Taliban, and they put their son in a car, and they tried to drive him over the border into Afghanistan, but we caught them, and this is yet another success story. So many of the police women that were there were kind of, you know, just shaking their heads a little bit and sort of saying, and I asked them what was going on, and they said, well, what happened was that even though fewer than 1% of us are female. It happened that at that night, that evening, at a border control checkpoint between Afghanistan and Pakistan, we had a female officer serving. And what had happened was that the Taliban had put this boy in a burqa, drugged him, and put him in the back seat and tried to drive through. And this woman, this officer, had noted that this person was behaving oddly because women, only women can search other women. She tried to take him out of the car, search, and discovered that it was the son. And so what was striking to me was, you know, a lot of things. One being that the Taliban in particular had planned that whole operation assuming that they wouldn't encounter women in security forces. And then also we didn't actually know the benefit, the operational benefit of having women as a result of that story. And, you know, that's an example related to one case, but we've seen a whole lot of women playing increasingly important roles in research and study and policymaking around terrorism and violent extremism. And I think it's really helped us move from what's often a really reductive view of saying, you know, either women are just victims of terrorism, or sometimes that most women are mothers of young men who are vulnerable to recruitment. And that's part of it, but there's such a broader spectrum of things that we need to consider when we're thinking about, you know, why we need women in all aspects of security. And so we've really evolved now, still not where it needs to be, but we've evolved to the fact that we understand often that women are both, you know, terrorists themselves, they're vulnerable to recruitment, they are recruiting others. You know, I could go on.
Oui, c'est parfait. Puis je suis totalement d'accord aussi. Il y a la perception dans le public au large que les femmes ne sont pas violentes, mais les femmes sont violentes aussi. Puis c'est un aspect qui n'est pas considéré dans les analyses. On pense que ça n'arrive pas. But there's a huge percentage of women that are actually radicalized and become violent. So I think we have to talk more about that.
Absolutely. I often cite, you know, sometimes we still think about gender or GBA+ or women as kind of an add-on or a nice to have, but many of our adversaries are building it into their operational plans and their strategy. They don't call it with the same terminology, but, you know, ISIS, 1 out of 5 foreign fighters or fighters from North America and Europe who left to go to the Middle East to fight for ISIS were women. 20% were women. You know, Boko Haram has 2/3 of its suicide bombers are women. And part of that is strategy because women can enter markets. They can enter busy places without being searched. They attract less attention. There are a lot of ways that women are both kind of strategically and tactically engaged in violent extremism or terrorism, and limiting our perception of their roles or reducing them to real stereotypes doesn't serve anybody.
Exactly. I'm going to move on to number 4. Donc, inclure les femmes dans la prise de décision, tant dans les conflits que dans le maintien de la paix, renforce la reconstruction et les liens avec la communauté. Comment le gouvernement canadien s'assure-t-il que les voix des femmes sont entendues et que les femmes elles-mêmes sont représentées tant au pays qu'à l'étranger?
Nous le faisons de nombreuses façons. Le plus important étant que nous l'avons désigné comme priorité. Et nous avons un plan d'action complet pour y parvenir. Et pour être clair, nous faisons des progrès dans ce domaine depuis des décennies grâce au travail de nombreuses personnes à l'intérieur et à l'extérieur du gouvernement, des forces armées, de la GRC. Et maintenant, nous sommes à mi-parcours de notre deuxième plan d'action national qui compte désormais 8 ministères et la GRC comme partenaires de mise en œuvre. Il y a 3 partenaires principaux, les Affaires mondiales Canada, le ministère de la Défense nationale, les Forces armées canadiennes et la GRC. Et le Canada dispose également d'un parlement et d'une société civile très, très engagée. Et nous faisons beaucoup et bien sûr, il y a beaucoup d'opportunités encore pour améliorer, toujours. Mais nous faisons beaucoup. Par exemple, nous améliorons les processus internes, par exemple, par renforcer la CS+. Nous essayons également toujours d'obtenir un soutien directement aux organisations de base dirigées par des femmes. et nous essayons toujours de soutenir d'autres pays et leurs efforts par rapport à défendre la paix et la sécurité. So, par exemple, le général Vance dirige actuellement le réseau de chefs d'état-major pour la défense, pour la femme, la paix et la sécurité. Alors, il l'a fait passer d'un très petit nombre de pays à plus de 50. Et il n'y a qu'une seule femme chef d'état-major de la défense dans le monde. Alors, le Canada a donc créé et vraiment renforcé un groupe d'hommes qui discutent avec d'autres hommes de l'importance des femmes, la paix et la sécurité. Je crois que ça, c'est du leadership.
Oui, en effet, je travaille avec le réseau, justement, des femmes paix et sécurité.
Excellent.
So, I'm going to go on with Anna for question number 5.
All right. So, question number 5, Ambassador O'Neill. If you could implement one thing within your role, be it a policy, program, service, right now with the snap of your fingers, that would support the Women, Peace, and Security agenda, what would it be and why?
I would influence the curricula of every single course, every single professional military education program offered across our government and to Canadian forces. So in an ideal world, we wouldn't have sessions about women, peace, and security that are, you know, a designated hour at the end of a period or at the end of a discussion on a theme. They're not always at this case, but I think we have a long way to go in terms of looking at how this idea, the idea that women are not just victims, the specific ways that different operations can impact men, women, boys, girls, people of other identities, you know, all kinds of dynamics related to this. I'd love to see them be incorporated into every single class that is taught, training, exercise that we have. And you know, I taught a class on this at Georgetown University on women, peace, and security, and I have done a fair amount of trainings and workshops, including with police and military around the world. And one of my favorite things to do to start is to show a video, and maybe some of you have done this exercise, but you show a video, and it's a video of a group of people, like four or five people playing basketball. They're just kind of passing the ball to each other. And you ask the students, people in class, to say, I'm going to show you this 1 minute video, and I want you to count how many times people pass the ball to each other. So they, you know, they're just kind of running in a circle, passing the ball to each other. And you stop the video, and people say, well, some people like, I had 36, I counted 34, whatever. People start discussing. And there's always some students that have this kind of weird look on their face. And at some point you say, okay, well, who noticed the gorilla? People say, what? And in this video, you show it to them again, and people are just watching, playing, you know, they're passing the ball to each other. And at one point in this 1 minute video, somebody dressed up in a gorilla costume walks right in the middle of the circle that they're passing the ball, like pounds on his or her chest, and then walks away. And truly, on, like, without exception, about half the students notice the gorilla and half of them don't. And I think it's a great example to use because I went through, you know, university, grad school, a number of courses, and I didn't have this concept really introduced to me in my teaching. So I wasn't told that there are dynamics related to gender and conflict, that there can be early warning indicators that are gendered or that people experience different things differently. And I wasn't told kind of to look for them or taught how to look for them. And so they were probably there, but I didn't see them. And so it becomes a thing of, you know, what's the gorilla in this example? What were we not looking for, but was present? And what were we not trained or conditioned to look for? Not because we're bad people, but because it wasn't put in that context before. So my dream would be to make sure that as we're creating these exceptionally professional and capable, you know, diplomats and academics and military and police, we're really giving them as many tools as possible. And we're not waiting until like the midpoint of their career to introduce the idea that that women, peace, and security matters.
I think that would be an amazing thing to be implemented within, honestly, more things than just government and our Canadian Armed Forces. I think it could really extend, like you were saying, to academic institutions and what have you, especially the gorilla in the room, the elephant.
Yeah,
in the room,
we're working on it. We're working on it. Now, a lot of great folks within D&D CAF and elsewhere who are you know, who are really working to integrate this. And it's just how quickly can we go and how much capacity do we have to keep working on it. But there are a lot of great initiatives and efforts already underway to make this happen.
Oh, well, that was just such a great conversation. Thank you for tuning us. It was like a perfect note to end on. You really, really wrapped it up well. And I'm going to look into this video now. Might have to
it's on
email
YouTube.
You after, ask for this gorilla video.
Anybody can find it. Everyone listening now knows the secret, but do it with your family. My husband, who was in the Canadian Army, didn't see the gorilla. So do it with friends and family, and you can just Google it and it'll show up.
Sounds great. I'm terrified of monkeys, so I feel like I would get it almost immediately. It's like a big phobia. So I feel like watching it will be interesting for me, but I'm excited to watch my family interact with that video.
Good luck.
Thank you.
And remember, they're not bad people or not simple if they don't see it. It's just that they're often focused on the task you gave them.
Exactly. Well, thank you again for speaking with us today. We so appreciate it.
Thanks to both of you.
Merci beaucoup.
Thanks everybody listening. Merci à tous et à toutes.
Thank you for listening. This was the third and last podcast in our three-part series on the anniversary of UNSCR 1325 and the Women, Peace, and Security Agenda. Be sure to check out our previous two podcasts and have a great day.